sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and Friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is Andrea Simon, author of the new novel, Floating in the Never Sink, and the memoir, Beshert, A Granddaughter's Holocaust Quest. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, our Shinshinim, our young representatives of Israel, Shai Friedwald and Daniel Levy, and our Mevina on Israel, Inbal Shtivi. Please email your comments to us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at 2JewishRadio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and 2 Jewish.
Shalom, Chag Sameach and Moadim LeSimcha. This is a Jewish season of rejoicing and celebrating. Seventh day of Sukkot today, also known as Hoshana Rabbah, part of our Zman Simchatenu, the season of our great joy. We have a special non-festival reason to celebrate today, by the way, because, believe it or not, this marks the 900th edition of the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and Friends. The 900th presentation of great Jewish ideas, guests, news, controversy, music, humor, and food. Not that you can see what I'm eating while I broadcast Two Jewish on the radio, of course, but the rest of Two Jewish is all for your public consumption. When you have done anything for 900 straight weeks, it definitely demonstrates something. Perhaps that I simply have no ability to stop doing something once I start on it, I suppose. But it's rather astonishing to think that for the past 900 weeks, we here at Two Jewish have been presenting a show that seeks to cover everything that matters in the Jewish world, and we plan to keep doing so for, oh, who knows how long. Our goal has always been to show just how interesting, diverse, funny, inspiring, entertaining, challenging, and important Judaism and Jews are. And we hope we've maintained the high standards we've always strived for in our work. As the saying goes, we here at Two Jewish hope to continue to go from strength to strength with your support and encouragement. Thank you for 900 shows supported by our listeners here at Two Jewish. Now, back to the endless cycle of Jewish fall festivals that we are almost done with. Yesterday in Temple, we chanted from the great book Ecclesiastes, Kohelet, from the last part of the Hebrew Bible, traditionally chanted on the Sabbath of Sukkot, Shabbat Sukkot. But if you don't recall this classic Bird's version of Pete Seeger's setting of the biblical text, recorded back in 1965, well, you are in for something pretty great. Pretty sure that song has been used to typify the mid-60s in like 50 movies, including Forrest Gump, and I've heard that it's the pop song with the earliest text ever used. That is, the song that took the oldest piece of literature in history. It takes a passage from Kohelet, this 2,300-year-old book, although according to Jewish tradition, King Solomon supposedly wrote the book of Ecclesiastes 2,900 years ago or so. If it was Solomon who wrote it, I wonder where they sent the royalty checks. Of course, he was royalty. Never mind. Anyway, tomorrow we conclude this long fall festival season and put the extreme holiday experience of Judaism behind us. But before that happens, tomorrow will be the festival of Shmini Atzeret, the eighth day of assembly for Sukkot, and an independent holiday when we say the blessing for rain, Geshem, and lovingly remember our ancestors once more with Yizkor prayers. And tomorrow night we will celebrate Simchat Torah, the joyous celebration of Torah, the wonderful festival. We complete the reading of Torah and begin again from Bereishit, Genesis. Before we leave this festival season in our rearview mirror, I have one personal favorite anecdote to share about Simchat Torah. The genesis of this particular story goes back to when I was living in Jerusalem, a rabbinic student. Having grown up, knowing that Simchat Torah was a wide-open, fun festival, on the night of Simchat Torah, we went looking for a good party. You know, dancing with the Torahs, lots of loud singing, and a schnapps or two or three to celebrate. What we discovered is that's not the way Jerusalemites, Yerushalmim, celebrate Simchat Torah. After wandering the Jewish quarter of the old city of Jerusalem looking for revelry, we found a couple of decent Torah readings, plenty of stately hakafot, Torah processionals, but no real parties. We decided to try the ultra-Orthodox area, Mea Shearim. Again, no great parties, no Jews dancing in the streets, none of the festivities we associate with Simchat Torah here in America. Finally, having found a bottle or two of Arak along the way, we decided to create our own Simchas Torah, and a group of us began singing and dancing in the middle of a quiet intersection at the entrance to Mea Shearim. We worked up enough enthusiasm to attract a group of younger Orthodox Jews, really kids, willing to come dance with the Meshuggah American revelers, singing Ki Heim Chayenu Hoshia Et Amecha and other Torah songs. We were finally having a good time when we heard a plop on the pavement near us, then another, then another. We finally realized that the neighbors living nearby in Mea Shearim were pelting us with fruit, and they were using their leftover etrogim, their etrogs, citrons from the holiday of Sukkot they didn't need anymore. That could only have happened in Jerusalem. For a last add on our fall celebrations and on Simchat Torah, here's the song Shalom Rav Leohave Toratecha, Great Peace of Those Who Love the Torah. It's from our house rock band, Avanim.
Shalom Rav Leohave Toratecha.
Was Avanim playing Shalom Rav Leohave Toratecha, Great Peace of They Who Love the Torah. Our guest this morning, Andrea Simon, wrote the excellent Holocaust memoir, Beshert, and has now published a new novel, Floating in the Never Sink. Meet her in a moment here on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town, amazing dining, and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
We welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning. Andrea Simon is the author of the new novel, Floating in the Never Sink, a novel and stories. She's also the author of Beshert, Granddaughter's Holocaust Quest, which is a memoir. And really interesting book. Good morning. Welcome to Too Jewish. So it's a shift to go from writing nonfiction to fiction. Tell us about that.
Well, I've been writing both all my life, really. And I would say about 30 years ago, I stopped writing for corporate America and I started writing my own work. And I've written several novels and several short stories and a lot of essays and sort of funny pieces and all kinds of things. So the Beshert book also was followed by a novel called Esther is Alive, which took the story from Beshert, the factual story, into a more fictional realm. I felt I could enlarge the theme in a more personal way. So writing Floating in the Never Sink maybe is a kind of progression or more of intensification of the fictional world.
So how much of this is based on autobiographical experience? Flatbush, the Catskills, any relationship to your life?
You're talking about Floating now.
Floating in the Never Sink, yes, of course.
Yes. Well, I would say it's semi-autobiographical in the sense that it's most of my memories are pretty accurately portrayed in terms of the house we lived in terms of the village, although I didn't include the real village name just in case somebody would be insulted. But anyone who knows the Catskills could probably figure out where it is. Also the same Brooklyn environment. As far as the people goes, some of it were based on real people, some weren't, some changed. You know, it's a book that I started 30 years ago and I have been working on and off since then. So I keep changing things and adding stories and adding characters and taking them out. So probably I would say at this point it's maybe half and half.
Novel Floating in the Never Sink takes you back to an era in New York that I think many of our listeners either have experienced or have experienced in books and in film. We will continue in just a few moments here on Too Jewish. Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a new Jewish synagogue in the northwest of Tucson and the Catalina foothills, is celebrating services, classes, and events this fall, and our very first Simchat Torah tomorrow night. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has already created a vibrant and vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. A new progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Congregation Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the Tucson metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services Friday and Saturday, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Beit Simcha is located at 7315 North Oracle Road, just north of Ina on the west side of Oracle. Services, classes, and events are open to everyone. Join us this Friday night, 7315 North Oracle Road. Shabbat evening services are at 6:30 p.m. Saturday morning Torah study with bagels and lox is at 9 a.m., followed by Shabbat morning services at 10 a.m., all with me leading them. Join us for Shabbat, 7315 North Oracle Road, Congregation Beit Simcha, the west side of Oracle, north of Ina. For Shmini Atzeret and Simchat Torah, everyone's welcome. Tomorrow morning, Monday, join us as we complete the holiday of Sukkot with a Yisker service for Shmini Atzeret at 9:30 a.m., and then the terrific celebration of Simchat Torah, singing, dancing, and a special treat for every child present. Come to Beit Simcha at 6:30 p.m. Monday night. Celebrate this fabulous festival of the Torah with great joy. For more information about Congregation Beit Simcha, to attend services, our great religious school and Torah Tikes program, bar and bat mitzvah, confirmation, and high school programs, and rich array of adult education academy courses, and, of course, all of our services, go to www.beitsimchatucson.org, B-E-I-T-S-I-M-C-H-A, Tucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675, BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the newest Jewish community in southern Arizona at its exciting beginning. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or a kvel, please email us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18@gmail. Or visit our website at 2JewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through our website, 2JewishRadio.com, streaming us from there or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store. It's a very popular Jewish podcast. Top 10 in America, according to Moment magazine. We welcome our expert in the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
And Chag Sameach. We've been talking about the connection or the relationship between religious institutions or religions and are they large corporate entities? Are they businesses? Are they something else? And last week we were talking about how Judaism evolved a very different way from the way the Catholic Church did, particularly after the destruction of the Second Temple, the diaspora, the period in which the Talmud is developed, the synagogues become the central institutions of Jewish life. They're never really centralized under one authority. There's somebody called an exilarch for a while, the leader of the people in exile, which is almost all the Jews, but he never really has that kind of dominant authority. He's never at the head of some large financial collective or anything.
Right, and that position wasn't even created until like the 7th century when right. the Muslim capital moved to Baghdad, and they had this huge, extensive empire that went all the way to Spain. And there were Jews throughout, and they wanted one interlocutor through whom they could speak to all the Jews. So they created this institution called the exilarch that really only mattered to them. It mattered to the Muslim caliphs in Baghdad. And the caliphate in Baghdad lasted until the middle of the 13th century when Baghdad was sacked by the Mongols. But the institution of the exilarch was really never a key player at all. Jews notoriously had a hard time recognizing authority, even God's authority, even divine authority. They rebelled against it many times.
I think we still do.
And so it was sort of almost against Jewish character to develop a centralized hierarchy and full of authoritarian figures like bishops and cardinals and archbishops, whatever. But I mean, I think one of the key differences is that after initial tensions between church and state were overcome largely under Constantine the Great, who convened the Council of Nicaea and insisted that all Catholics have one creed. So the Nicene Creed was elaborated and revised about a dozen times during the course of the 4th century. But by the beginning of the 5th century, there was not only a creed, the balance of power had shifted. So the emperor became weaker than the pope. And the emperor's authority, to a large extent, depended on his relations with the papacy. And the papacy itself had some great popes, some weaker popes, some very corrupt popes at the end of the 15th century, the famous Renaissance popes like the Borgias. I mean, they were a mixed bag because, after all, they were human. But starting in the 5th century and lasting even until today, to a very great extent, the ultimate authority, the Pope, was unquestioned by most Catholics around the world. There was never an equivalent position in Judaism. Rabbis, synagogues, et cetera, did develop after the destruction of the Second Temple and the establishment of Jewish communities throughout the Mediterranean world in particular. You know, at one point, 10% of the population of the Roman Empire was Jewish. So if you go by those numbers today, in Europe, there would be 20 million Jews. Well, there aren't 20 million Jews in the whole world, never mind in Europe. Right. So Jewish history didn't proceed exactly smoothly.
Not quite, no.
But it never felt the need to develop quite the corporate structure that Roman Catholicism did. And we still haven't talked about Islam, Buddhism, Hinduism, and others, which we should probably touch on at least briefly next week.
Sounds good. Tom, thanks so much. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
As a general principle, Jewish holidays are divided between days on which you must starve and days on which you must overeat. Although most Reform, Conservative, Progressive Jews are more familiar with the overeating holidays and fast only on Yom Kippur, More observant Jews may observe no fewer than 16 fasts throughout the Jewish year, based on the time-honored principle that even if you are sure that you are ritually pure, you definitely aren't. In any case, although there are many Jewish feasts and fasts, there are no holidays that require just light snacking. Now, unlike Christians who attend church on special days, like, say, Ash Wednesday, on Jewish holidays, most Jews take the day off. This is because Jews, for historical and personal reasons, are more stressed out than Christians. So, anyway, here is your handy diet guide to the Jewish holidays, starting with Rosh Hashanah, with which we began the year at the end of September, and going forward through the fall, winter, spring, and summer, all categorized in the most Jewish way by their dietary requirements. Here we go. Rosh Hashanah, feast. Tzom Gedalia, fast. Yom Kippur, more fasting. Sukkot, feast. Hoshana Rabbah, more feasting. Simchat Torah, keep feasting. The month of Cheshvan, no feasts or fast for a whole month. Get a grip. Chanukah, eat latkes, potato pancakes. Tenth of Tevet, fast. Do not eat potato pancakes. Tu Bishvat, feast. Fast of Esther, fast. Purim, eat pastry. Passover, do not eat pastry. Shavuot, feast, but only on cheesecake and blintzes. 17th of Tammuz, fast. Definitely don't eat cheesecake or blintzes. Tisha B'Av, very strict fast. Don't even think about cheesecake or blintzes. The month of Elul, end of the cycle. Enroll in the Oprah Winfrey Center for Eating Disorders before the Jewish High Holy Days arrive again. I hope that's all clear now. We welcome Inbal Shtivi, the director of the Weintraub Israel Center, our Mivina in Israel. Boker Tov.
Boker Tov.
And Chag Sameach.
Thank you.
We're approaching the end of the endless fall Jewish holiday season. It begins with, I don't know, Slichot. It goes through Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, Sukkot, Shmini Atzeret, Simchat Torah. In Israel, Sukkot is a vacation time.
Yes.
And
it is.
You go on vacation with your kids?
Yes, we go on vacation. The Jewish school system is off.
Which is all school systems,
yeah,
you know,
which
from
is
most Israelis.
Yeah, most Israelis go to this. Yeah, it's off. It's quite similar to what our family experiences here in the Jewish system here.
And your kids are in a Jewish day school here.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
The only difference is everybody else isn't off here.
Exactly, yeah.
And they you're expected to work. It's a tricky balance.
It's a tricky balance. This issue of balancing work and life or family is something that also happens in Israel in this time of the year. You get to have sometimes 9 days of work.
In a month.
Right. And it's very frustrating because you want to advance things and you... And so many people are out of town, out of the country, so it's very...
I went scuba diving during Sukkot when I lived in Israel, you know, it's a great time, nice time of year, the fall.
Yes, the fall, the weather is simply perfect.
Perfect,
so that's what it's like to be in Sukkot in Israel. Everybody's on vacation.
You know, we used to joke that you were not a real Israeli until you were doing the work for your second job while you were at your third job. Because it was tough. Economically, it was very tough in Israel. It's not so much that way now, right? It's a much more vital economy. But still, Israelis hustle, right? You work hard.
You work hard, yes. You work hard. And you definitely, you have to. You have to work hard in order to...
succeed at
to
all,
succeed,
right?
Actually, and maintain your...
Now, we say that it's the same. Americans work more hours than a lot of other countries. Mm-hmm. We have a work... I don't know if it's a work ethic. It's different. In Europe, you know, France, they used to have 5-6 weeks of vacation. In Australia, mm-hmm. you get a month of vacation, you go away. It doesn't matter if you just started a job. You take it, they give you money in advance. There's all kinds of different ways of experiencing it. America people don't get very much vacation. In Israel, they get vacation, but somehow there's a need to keep hustling. I don't know if that's incorrect, but that's always been my perception.
No, I don't remember now what the law says for how many days a year are for vacation. I don't remember if it's 14 or 15.
In like 2 or 3 weeks.
Two or three weeks.
Yeah.
That you usually...
But that doesn't count all the chagim, right? It doesn't count all the Jewish holidays.
It doesn't count all the chagim because chagim is chagim.
Right.
So we get kind of a lot of vacation, but still there are far more working days with the kids
out of school.
Out of school.
Then there are vacation times.
Then there are vacation yeah. with the family. So talking about balancing work and family life, there is a bigger gap there. Definitely, that's for sure.
Very interesting and true, particularly right now around Sukkot. Listen, Chag Sameach and Mazel Tov on finishing the holidays. Your kids will be back in school for a
Thank
while.
Thank God, really.
We'll talk next week.
Thank you.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie New, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Toward the end of the Shabbos morning service, Rabbi Goldstein asked his congregation, on Yom Kippur a couple weeks ago, I asked you to all forgive your enemies. So, how many of you have forgiven your enemies? 80% of the congregation holds up hands. Rabbi Goldstein asks again, come now, we can do better than that. How many of you have forgiven your enemies? Everybody raises a hand this time, except one very elderly man, Mr. Steinberg. Mr. Steinberg, it's good to see you here today. Good Shabbos. Aren't you willing to forgive your enemies? I don't have any, he replies gruffly. Mr. Steinberg, that's amazing. How old are you? I'm 98 years old, he replies proudly. Congregation oohs, ahs. Okay, Mr. Steinberg, says the rabbi, would you please tell us how a person can live 98 years and not have a single enemy in the world? The old man slowly rises, faces the congregation, and says simply, I've outlived all the momzels. That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. You see, momzers are, it's a bad word, not good people. We welcome our Shin Shinim, our young representatives of Israel, representing the Weintraub Israel Center, but really representing the country of Israel. Boker Tov.
Boker Mitzan.
So Israeli music has gone through many permutations over the years. Tremendous number of successful Israeli pop stars. What kind of music do you guys like? And do you find that it's similar to the American music you're hearing? But with Israeli artists doing the same stuff like that, tell us about it.
Yeah, so actually a lot of music genres came originally from here in the States, pop, hip-hop, rap. And we have a lot of singers that sing that style in Hebrew, though. Yesterday we passed an activity in a school, and then we just played a song, a rap song.
Which song by whom?
Peled.
Ah,
the rapper, better the rapper. Mani Niralcha, who do I look like? And then we played that song, and then one student said, "Hey, isn't that Shimon Peres?" So it was really nice,
entertaining.
Yeah, but yeah, a lot of music comes originally from here.
Who do you guys like? Who are your favorite artists?
I feel like we don't really have a choice because on the radio we just have the same artist.
Well, you don't have as many stations in Israel, right? You
know, we don't, but like here we have just like the same stations on repeat, and like it doesn't leave us so much choice to like discover new people because it's just like the same all over. And well, I do feel like because like pop comes like does come from the US, so like many songs
they're kind
similar,
of like American
exactly.
songs but in Hebrew.
Yes.
Yeah.
We do have Idan Reichel, which I like a lot. He
a past guest of Too Jewish.
Exactly, he was
Idan
here
Reichel.
And
wonderful.
Yes,
very creative musician who
yes.
blends Ethiopian style.
Exactly,
with,
he has
styles,
very special music
stuff, and with rock and
yes.
other stuff. Do you guys like rap? Do you think rap has an authentic Hebrew voice now?
I don't like it.
Danielle
at all.
Doesn't like
I
it.
I feel
Shai
like
likes
Israelis
it.
Are new to rap because, like, in America, it's been for like years, and in Israel,
oh, yeah.
I think we're just like getting into it now. So we're not the best at it, I would say, but
yeah, I think like if you translate the lyrics of American rap, so maybe you have one nice word in that.
There's a lot of harsh
words.
The language is pretty bad.
Yeah,
often.
Yeah. But yeah, I like a lot of music genres like Omer Adam, Chava Alberstein.
So you really go
Shlomo Arzi,
old
yeah,
school,
right?
Huh?
But also, as she said, like on. here in the radio. So like 2 months in a row, they play just 5-6 familiar songs
that
are hits.
The hits.
And I felt like, oh, are we coming to America? This is America. Maybe we will listen to all of his songs. And in Israel, like all the songs are changing. And here
it's the same stuff. Yeah, you know, not that Israel doesn't have a commercial culture, but I do remember driving around Israel listening to about the same 8 songs on, what's the station? Galgalas. Yeah, okay, oh my God. And the same commercials. But that can happen, in, of course, in Israel too. But I do think that they change quicker. It's less sort of imbued in the culture. Well,
yeah. Because we have Hebrew and English.
Right.
And there's like more variety in here. Like only English.
Only English. And, I know, it's tragic. Listen, we'll find you some good music to listen to. Right, we'll talk next week. Lihitraot.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
And now a word of Torah. This coming Shabbat, we read the spectacular portion of Bereishit, Genesis, the first one, the beginning of all things. It starts with those still amazing words, Bereishit bara Elohim, at the beginning of God's creating, or in the beginning God created. Simple, lucid, and concise, all creation emanating from one point and place. A divine force or intelligence or energy starting the great process of existence and eventually life. A singularity, a poem to the holy unity of all being, everything coming from the same source. And yet the text of Genesis is deliberately ambiguous in order to encourage exploration and debate. The essential tools we human beings have for learning truth and discerning meaning. Questions abound. Why is God necessary at all for creation? As the great Jewish poet Paul Celan wrote, no one needs us out of earth and clay. No one summons our dust. Blessed art thou, no one. I'd argue with Celan that such a wonder as creation did not come into being purely by accident, but there is room for argument, which is good, and perhaps God-given as well as very, very Jewish. The notion that God created and then saw each thing as good provoked from the great British author D.H. Lawrence the poetic speculation that the true mystery of creation is the divine urge of creation, a great strange urge. Even an artist knows his work was never in his mind. He could never have thought it before it happened. God is a great urge, wonderful, mysterious, magnificent, but he knows nothing beforehand. His urge takes shape in the flesh, and lo, it is creation. God looks on it himself in wonder for the first time. Lo, there is a creature formed. How strange. Let me think about it. Let me form an idea. We can argue, discuss, and explore whether such a marvel as the intricate workings of our world or our bodies, even a single cell, could exist without some coherent plan or design. What a rich area for intellectual and spiritual engagement. Genesis is where real understanding and learning begin. This is where we start to shape our faith and our theology. This text and our response to it helps form our own character. That's how Torah commences, with the invitation to begin exploring a great and holy text, in partnership with God, in community with the whole people of Israel. Our guest this morning, Andrea Simon, explains for her what makes creativity happen and what makes for good Jewish literature. Find out when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
A primary school teacher in England was fired after allegedly joking to pupils about sending them to the gas chamber if they failed to finish their work. This teacher at Newbury's Primary School in Hertfordshire, United Kingdom, made the anti-Semitic remark to a class of 28 pupils, 11 of whom are Jewish. She said to her students, "You better finish off your work quickly, or I'll ship you all off to the gas chambers." The teacher reportedly apologized afterwards, said she was joking, and asked the students not to say anything. The students reported the anti-Semitic comments to parents, who then shared their outrage on WhatsApp groups at the school. An emergency meeting was then held by the school's board of governors. The same day the comments were made, the teacher was dismissed immediately. A spokesman for Newberry's primary school in Hertfordshire said, "We can confirm last week we were made aware that an alleged racist comment had been made by an agency teacher working with the school. We acted on this immediately, and our governors and leadership team are undertaking a full investigation. The agency teacher will not be returning." A parent said, to the credit of the school, they made it clear they wanted to deal with the situation without delay. The school said religious leaders from different faith groups would be invited to speak to the children after sending a newsletter reassuring parents they were doing all they could to embrace diversity. Anti-Semitic abuse is on the rise in the EU, according to research from the Vienna-based European Union Agency for Fundamental Rights. The greatest number of anti-Semitic incidents were registered in Germany, the Netherlands, and Belgium. The fewest were registered in the UK, France, and Italy. Ioannis Dimitrakopoulos, a scientific advisor to the EU, said that growing European anti-Semitism is the result of European societies becoming increasingly intolerant, noting that there, of course, exists a link between growing right-wing populism in Europe and anti-Semitism. In happier news from Europe, in Stuttgart, Germany, Israeli gymnast Artem Dolgopiat won the silver medal in the men's floor exercise at the Artistic Gymnastics World Championships last week, cementing his position as one of the world's leading gymnasts. Dolgopiat scored 15.2 points, just behind Filipino gymnast Carlos Yulo, who took the gold with a score of 15.3. This is Dolgopiat's second silver at the World Championships, after his previous win back in 2017. This victory makes him the first Israeli to win two silvers at the World Championship. Dolgopiat immigrated to Israel from Ukraine at the age of 12. He is a favorite in his specialty for the Olympic gold in 2020. And finally, Harold Bloom, the influential literary critic born to a Yiddish-speaking family of Orthodox Jews, died at 89. Bloom, a member of the faculty at Yale since 1955, died in New Haven, Connecticut. He taught his final class at Yale just a few days ago. A fierce defender of the Western literary canon, "Shakespeare is God," he once declared. Bloom also was the author of dozens of books, several of them bestsellers. He coined the term "school of resentment" to refer to those critics whom he believed prioritized the social and political value of literary works over their artistic merit. His 1990 The Book of Jay, a commentary on David Rosenberg's translation of the Torah, identifies Jay, the name that biblical critics scholars give to the author of the oldest sections of the Pentateuch, the Torah, as a woman who lived at the time of King Solomon. Kabbalah and Criticism by Bloom explored the methods of interpretation employed by the developers of the great Jewish mystical tradition. "I am nothing if not Jewish," Harold Bloom said in 2003. "I spoke Yiddish before I spoke English. I still read Yiddish poetry. I recite Yiddish poetry to myself. I really am a product of Yiddish culture. But I can't understand a God who could be all-powerful and all-knowing, who would allow the Nazi death camps and, well, schizophrenia." Harold Bloom is gone at 89. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world. We are delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning. Andrea Simon is the author of the new novel and stories, Floating in the Never Sink, although maybe it's not so new. Maybe this is something you've had for a while and it just now it's gotten into print. What's a fair assessment on that?
I would say, as I mentioned before, about 30 years ago, I was at a sort of writing crossroads in my life, and a friend of mine and I sat down with Natalie Goldberg's book, I think it was called Writing Down the Bones, and we decided to follow a free writing prompt that called for a magical time in childhood. And I began to focus on something that happened to me in the Catskill Mountains during my childhood, and my pen dug deeply into the paper, and I realized I was onto something, and that sort of became one of the stories in the current book called The Horizontal Weed on a Country Road. And I started writing a novel of growing up in both places, in Brooklyn and the Catskills. And then I had some literary people tell me it should be a young adult book, and maybe you should cut it in half, and maybe you should take out the Brooklyn stuff, and maybe you should do this and that and whatever. And then I got diverted into other projects, and I've kind of put it aside. And through the years, I kept going back to it because it was such a... It was my, you know, like your first love. And I added stories, and I made each chapter into more of a short story. And then 5 years ago, I finished my MFA at a fairly older years. And during that time that I was in my MFA program, I used some of the chapters as short story assignments, and I got a lot of encouragement from people and added more. And ta-da, here's the current version. So it's been a work in progress for a long time.
So I have to call you out on something in the book.
Oh, did I?
Well, no, but I find it fascinating. You talk about your father, a man of limited taste, loved all of the New York baseball teams. Nobody loved the Dodgers, Giants, and Yankees. You have to clarify that for us.
Oh, my God. I have to do another edition for that. Well, I think he loved them all. He loved the whole game. You know, I think he was definitely, in his later years, a Mets fan. There was no question.
Sure.
That if he had to choose between the Mets and the Yankees, it would have been the Mets. But don't forget, this is a fictional character, so we can allow him.
All right. We can let him have those completely contradictory allegiances.
Right.
I have to say, I don't know about that.
Okay, if that's your only criticism I can of inaccuracy, I can breathe a little sigh of relief.
I'm not telling you to rewrite it in 14 different ways, I promise.
Well, listen, I am compulsive, and if somebody says that, I might do it.
You know, it's possible. In the next edition.
Right, exactly. Well, nowadays, with print on demand, you can keep doing new editions.
Yeah, you can keep changing your book as you go.
This will be the baseball accurate edition.
Right. The baseball corrected edition. Tell us a little bit about what it's like to write on demand, not obviously publish on demand, but having worked in which your writing was used for all kinds of, you know, commercial purposes, and then being able to write for yourself. What's the difference?
Well, there is a big difference. I had my own editorial production company for about 8 years before I gave myself over to fiction and nonfiction of the literary kind. And basically... before that, I worked in regular conventional jobs in publishing, and I wanted my own business because I wanted to have the freedom to do what I wanted to do. But, of course, that was ridiculous because clients are just as demanding as any kind of publishing boss. So I found myself constantly writing things or designing things and having them chopped up by people. So I got to the point where I just decided that it was time for me to do my own writing. So there's a difference in the sense that you have to listen to other people, and sometimes those people don't really know what they're talking about, or they don't have the they're not interested in the writing quality. They're more interested in getting that point across. So you're constantly making compromises, and I think that could be very difficult, especially since my first love was always literary writing, and I, you know, had to make a living.
Of course, you know, it's not the easiest job in the world, making a living as a writer, especially a creative
it's
writer.
Almost impossible. I was a teacher for a while, and every time a student said they wanted to major in English or become a writer, I have to say it wasn't so encouraging. I always told them to have a paying job first.
Yeah, don't give up the day job, ladies and gentlemen.
Right, exactly.
You heard it here on Too Jewish first.
The environment in Floating in the Never Sink, of course, is a very Jewish environment. Brooklyn, the Catskills, the summer colonies. Tell us a little bit about, it wasn't really, it's not focused on the Jewish identity, but it permeates the book. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I grew up pretty much in a secular household, even though my maternal grandfather was an Orthodox rabbi in Poland. He was very authoritarian, and my mother, I think, rebelled by going against formal religion. But I was always immersed in Jewish communities. You know, I lived in Flatbush where either you were Catholic or Jewish, and in the Catskills, obviously, everybody was Jewish. But, you know, not particularly religious, but, you know, observing of holidays and traditions. And it was a very Eastern European Jewishness, or very New York-oriented, I would say. So we became immersed in Yiddish and in the food and the way of speaking, which probably I'm showing it now. But it's a, you know, sort of intonation, and I don't think I ever realized that being Jewish was so influenced by where you live until I actually met Jews from other states, and I realized, what, they don't know Yiddish? What, they don't know what a real bagel is, you know? So I think I didn't escape it, is what I'm saying, and I was very attracted to the stories, especially that the grandmothers used to tell, you know, sprinkling in their Yiddish, and I was fascinated by any kind of immigrant story, and I became interested over the years in finding out more.
In writing a book in stories, you know, you kind of link the stories, right? But they probably weren't written in order.
No, they weren't. Originally, as I said before, it was a regular novel, and I had, you know, one chapter led to another chapter. And then I started just writing short stories, and I realized that I was more interested at the time that I was writing the stories in making a perfectly, or as much as I could, perfectly formed short story unto itself. So I did that, and because I was concentrating on the same characters all the time, I put it together in more of a chronological sequence. But, you know, many times one story doesn't lead to the other, but hopefully at the end you get a full picture of the life.
There's a dramatic incident that kind of shapes the whole story, really the whole book, although it also, you know, you don't want to give it away, spoiler alert here, but it really changes things, and yet then it's suppressed. Can you talk about that a little bit?
You're talking about the sexual abuse?
Yeah, of course.
Okay. Because to me, there's another, there are a few of them, but well, that would be.
But that's the most dramatic part to me. But
yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, originally I wrote the story, as I mentioned before, The Horizontal Weed, where the character, the family friend, makes inappropriate remarks and that type of stuff. And that was the end. And then several readers said to me they felt that I left that incident alone and I should come back to it. And so I began to write the other story about the actual incident. And I felt that somehow, I didn't want the whole book to be about that, but I wanted it to at least show certain, to explain why Mandy was the way she was in certain ways, in terms of feeling invisible and feeling like she couldn't really talk to anyone. And it was another theme of family secrets. So I wrote that story, and I came back to it at the very end of the story of the book as well, with her sister's remarks about it. I'm trying not to say too much to get it away.
Yeah, no, it's hard because it's dramatic.
Yeah.
Well, that and the Cadillac visit, and you know, it's just. Do you think this is an appropriate book, a young adult book, as well as an adult novel?
It's funny that you asked that, because when I wrote Esther is Alive, which is, she was even younger as the protagonist, but it's based on a real girl, she was between 7 and, I think, 13 during the book. And I never intended to write that as a young adult book, because it was about the Holocaust and about the whole story of the massacres, which, you know, was very, very graphic. And everyone said it was a young adult book in the same vein that Anne Frank is. And so I started speaking at middle schools, and people were urging me to read the massacre scenes and things like that. And the kids really got it. I mean, it's a different, sophisticated group of kids than it was in my day. I mean, they're not reading, Nancy Drew. They're reading real novels. So I would say that I think young adults, and maybe even younger than young adults, will definitely relate to Mandy, and the vocabulary and the perceptions that she has, I think, are very true to someone that age. Of course, with the sexual abuse and other issues, I think it would be up to the parents to decide whether they want their child to read that. You know, certainly you find that in other books. that are considered young adult nowadays.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that young adult has changed quite a bit in terms of how people perceive
it. And also the issue of friendship. A few of my friends who've read it said that they were most impressed by the terror of losing a best friend, and they remember that, you know, years later, and they thought that was very well done. So from that point of view, certainly young people could relate to that.
I want to shift a little bit and talk about Beshert, which was your Holocaust exploration. Tell us how that came about and how you ended up creating
it. Well, it's a kind of long story. I'll try and condense it a little.
Please.
But I would say in 1997, I have a good friend who works in the travel industry, and she was going with a group from the Federation of Southern Arizona to Belarus. It was one of the first groups to do that after the breakup of the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. And I knew my grandmother's village was in a town called Volchin, which is currently in Belarus but was in Poland in her day, and that we had family that stayed there and obviously were killed, but we never really knew what happened to them. So I told my friend I wanted to go on this trip, and I went with this group, which was amazing, and the leader of the group was Louis Posez, who you might have heard of, or maybe you knew him.
I knew him well, yeah.
Oh, you knew him well, so you know.
Louis Posez is a very special guy. Yeah.
Wonderful. And he had left Brest in 1939, and he left his family there to come to the United States. I'm not sure now if the reason. I think it was for the World's Fair or something like that. And anyway, he knew his family was killed, but he had just found out through this trip what happened to them. And they, like so many other people in that area, had been rounded up in a huge massacre in the forest where 50,000 Jews were killed. So, and then as a side trip, aside from going to this forest site, I went to my grandmother's village, and I met an Israeli group who was there also, and one of the members was an old Volchin person who happened to know my family. And it became, that's why we use the word Beshert in the sense of fate. And we became friends, and he led me on to some people in New York who were actually best friends of my family. And they had pictures of my family, and I had pictures of their family. And it became a whole story. And then the Jewish Federation asked me to write something about the massacre, or to actually do a documentary. But it didn't work out in that way, but I had accumulated so many notes about the actual massacre itself, and in those days it was pre-internet, so I did it, you know, the old-fashioned way, and I interviewed so many people that I decided to write it as a memoir.
Well, it's an extraordinary memoir. It's called Beshert, and called A Granddaughter's Holocaust Quest. It's you know, kind of elegantly written, a lot of detail, beautiful pictures, and I think also really great for our readers. Where can people go to find out more about you, Andrea?
Well, I have a website, AndreaSimon.net, so you can read some of my stories there, and the three books that we talked about, some reviews and things like that. And I'm perfectly happy and delighted to talk to anybody through email or in person.
I have to say, writers are really good about that.
They are.
Thank you for a great, great visit here on Too Jewish.
Oh, thank you so much.
My pleasure. The book is called Floating in the Never Sink, A Novel in Stories, but I also recommend the memoir Beshert. Thanks again. When we come back in a moment on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Thanks for being here on this 900th Too Jewish radio show with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday. Too Jewish, our guest will be Cheryl Half, author of the charming parody kids book, Goodnight Bubala. Our playout this morning is from Ernest Bloch's Sacred Service, Avodat HaKodesh, for Simchat Torah tomorrow night. Torat Adonai Tmimah, the Torah of God is pure and perfect.
Join us for Shmini Atzeret and Simchat Torah at my own congregation, Beit Simcha, if you're in southern Arizona. They are both tomorrow, October 21st. Morning services with Yisker Memorial begin at 9:30 a.m. at 7315 North Oracle Road, with the evening's full celebration of Simchat Torah at 6:30 p.m. Monday night, tomorrow night. Call 520-276-5675 or go to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org. My friends, may you have a Chag Sameach and Moadim LeSimcha. Happy holiday of Shmini Atzeret and Simchat Torah. I guess the last day of Sukkot today, technically. And a Shavua Tov, a good week always. A week, we pray, of peace.
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.